Der Geruch in una berushutet adokusho nigin yaharit in una ijavit kiman no pat biyarer puti garin me kamnek nenia Inuin
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, and we are here at Port Annapolis Marina in Annapolis, Maryland. And my boat is on the hard. I hauled her out a couple of weeks ago and I've been banging away on her ever since. Trying to get her back together again, really. The last couple of seasons in the Arctic has certainly had a toll on her. And there's just a lot of stuff that needed to be done. It's like, where do we even start here? So when I did a 2015, we spent 5 months up there doing research in the Arctic for NASA, for NASA's Ocean Melt in Greenland program, and we were in quite a bit of heavy ice, but I knew that in 2016 we were going to be in much heavier ice, so I was afraid that a chunk of ice, when you're in super thick ice, and a good example of this was if you go to my website, www.oceanresearchproject.org, and if you look at the Greenland Climate Project videos that are right there on the homepage. Now you look at video number 4, I think it's phase 4 is what it's called, you'll see us pushing through the type of ice I'm talking about. But when you're in real, real heavy ice, sometimes a piece of ice about the size of a cooler or a dorm fridge or something will actually come down your boat, and you'll hear it bouncing off your hull as you move forward. And eventually, it gets all the way down to back where your propeller is. And if your propeller is spinning and it hits a giant chunk of ice, you could very well throw a blade, screw your whole prop up, and that would be really bad because you're surrounded by ice. There's not much wind in these areas to sail out of there, and you'd just be stranded. And it could be really bad if there's a major calving activity. If a glacier, this ice is due to glaciers most of the time, if a giant chunk of the glacier falls off and you're just sitting there like a dead duck, it would be really bad. So I asked the guys in where I hauled the boat out in Sisimiut to put a cage around the prop. You know, it was really broken. I don't speak Greenlandic. I don't speak Danish, and those are the first two languages. English is the third language in Greenland. So it's sort of, you know, I thought they understood. I don't know, for whatever reason, I came back in 2016 and there wasn't a cage around the prop. So I had to take metal bar that I got out of the trash and bend it by hand and then sort of spot weld it to the boat. And it did its trick. You know, it definitely protected the prop and we didn't lose the prop and, you know, whatever, but it did slow the boat down because it's not a professionally done hydrodynamic version. It was like, you know, what you expect when you pull a bunch of metal out the trash, bend it by hand and weld it to your boat. So I had to cut that off, and, you know, we were mapping the seafloor last year down to 6,000 feet, and, we had the potential. We only mapped down to about 3,500, but we had the potential to map down to 6,000 feet. So there was a giant transducer the size of a cinder block and a big, giant metal housing that I had to cut off the boat. And so I'm sort of trying to just get the boat back to where it was, and it's a steel boat. And steel boats are constantly rusting. They say that rust never sleeps. And you can sort of slow it down. You can put it in a hyperbolic stasis chamber, so to speak. And you can slow it way down. But metal starts to rust, it really never stops. If you want a 40-foot boat and you don't have 40-foot boat money, you can get a steel boat for like half the price of a fiberglass boat, but you're going to basically become a painter. It's a whole lot of work. So that's about a lot of what I've been doing. And also I ripped out, they don't have pump out stations in the Arctic. So right before I left, I ripped out the holding tank and put in something called a thermosalinograph, which helps to do ground truthing for salinity satellites in outer space. And there's not a pump out facility in all of Greenland. There's not a marina in all of Greenland. So, you know, there's no reason to have the holding tank. And obviously now I'm back in the United States. I got to put a holding tank in the boat, replacing the head, the plumbing, you know, just replacing the entire system. So I've done, I don't know, countless haulouts. I've been living aboard for 12 years. I've had 5 different sailboats. I've hauled every single one of those boats out multiple times. And every single time I was doing it specifically for an expedition in mind. This is the first time I've ever hauled out a boat to basically make it a condo. Unfortunately, my engine is broken. I beat the hell out of my boat in the Arctic the last couple of years, and the engine was struggling on the way back down, and it just sort of gave up the ghost. So, you know, it's whatever. Either I'll fix it or I'll rip it out and put another one in. I don't have the money to do that right now, so... So anyways, just talking about haulouts. So how often do you need to haul out? I would suggest you don't need to haul out every year. Now, there's going to be places, depending on where you're at, depending on, you know, how cold it is. Some people, like in Maine or whatever, they might haul out in every winter. There's places where people haul out in the summer for hurricane season. But you can leave your boat in the water year-round for 2-3 years. If you're in a place like Annapolis and probably a lot of other places, you can hire a diver to go down for like $50 and just do a quick cleaning of your bottom. And if you do that, you know, twice a year, say once in the beginning of the season, once midway through the season, then, or, you know, or at the end of the season or whatever, you know, your boat will be perfectly fine. So, you know, where are you going to do it at? Well, I used to make the mistake of taking my boat across to the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay to the most podunk, cheapest little boatyard I could possibly find. And although the people there were typically really nice, and it's, you know, a beautiful location somewhere remote, the reality is you're working on your boat, you realize I need 3/4-inch machine screws, right? I need 3 screws. So you get in your car, you drive like 45 minutes to buy these 3 screws and then drive 45 minutes back. By the time you get done with this whole escapade, you've lost, you know, an hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours, just getting 3 screws. You've spent more money on gasoline than those 3 screws cost. So I do think that when you think about hauling out, if you're going to do your own work, you got to make sure that the marina is going to allow that. Because there are marinas that just won't let anybody do their own work. So make sure of that one. But also think about your proximity to a hardware store, your proximity to like a West Marine or some kind of chandlery. All that comes into play. Now, in Annapolis, it costs about $110 an hour to hire somebody to do work. It's a lot of motivation to do your own work. So once you haul the boat out, now let's say when you bought the boat, the boat was surveyed properly, which means it was hauled out and you got to see the underbody and so on. But when you haul out, there's always a little bit of a unknown. You're sort of hoping not to find anything too crazy. And, you know, sometimes you do find something crazy, but generally speaking, you know, it's just checking your cutlass bearing, putting new bottom paint on, replacing your zincs, and that's pretty much it. So cutlass bearing is straightforward. The cutlass bearing is where your shaft is, your propeller shaft, at where it comes out. It depends on the boat. Sometimes it's internal. Sometimes, you know, it's not. But the cutlass bearing only needs to be replaced maybe once every 10 years or something, depending on how much you use your boat. And you can know if you've got to replace it by taking the propeller and trying to jerk it back and forth. And if the entire shaft sort of clunks one way and clunks back, and it's not going to clunk more than just a little, you know, a fraction of an inch, but if you can pick it and you can move it, shake it and clunk it around, then you need to replace it. If you shake it and it doesn't really move, then it's fine. So zincs are straightforward. You just replace the zincs with whatever zincs were already there. I have a steel boat, so I have a ton of zincs. I have like $400 worth of zincs every single time I haul out. I have to replace. A fiberglass boat does not have nearly as many zincs, but that's pretty straightforward. But what about the bottom paint? So bottom paint, bottom paint is not all the same. And you basically have three types of bottom paint, although really only two types of bottom paint we really use, as typically speaking. One is an ablative paint. An ablative paint is softer. It's designed to wear away, sort of like the layers on a bar of soap, and taking everything with it. And so if you're going to use your boat regularly, and especially on a sailboat, that's it. You're going to be using ablative paint. And the other is hard paint. Hard paint is typically going to be used on like faster planing boats, like power boats and so on. And this has a biocide in it that slowly leaks out the hard paint. Now, hard paint really does not like to sit on the hard for the winter. So if you haul your boat out for the winter, just sitting out in the air, in the sort of atmosphere or whatever, is enough that it will not, it will lose its ability to produce that biocide when you put it back into water. Whatever you do, just try to figure out what paint was on it before. Like, you don't got to get all crazy with it. If you had ablative paint, use ablative paint. If you know the type of ablative paint, just use the same stuff. You don't have to strip your boat all the way down to fiberglass or whatever. You don't have to do that. Only have to do that once, maybe every 15 years, maybe longer, maybe every 20 years. Typically, you'll just be able to get away with a light sanding and a couple coats of paint, and boom, you're good. You don't need to spend $350 on paint. There is great paint out there that's $350 a gallon, but I generally use the middle grade stuff, like Micron CSE, for instance, just sort of the middle of the barrel. It's always done well. Actually, you know what worked really well for me this last time was Sherman Williams. Believe it or not, Sherman Williams makes ablative antifouling, and it was great. I didn't have any barnacles, but the boat was in the Arctic for the most part, where you're not going to get much. So there's been all these rumors about copper, which is known as cuprous oxide, which is one of the big elements in bottom paint that keeps things from growing on it. They've been talking about banning it. I think they started talking about banning it some time ago. California was originally leading the charge, but I guess it got cold feet because it never banned it completely. Washington State is the only state that is going to ban it as of right now. And so the rule is that no new recreational boats under 65 feet with copper-based bottom paint is going to be sold in Washington after January 1st, 2018. So they'll be the first to do it. And I think that, you're going to see, by 2020, you're going to see very little cuprous oxide, very little copper in paint anymore. Right now, you have about anywhere between 20 and 70% cuprous oxide by weight in bottom paint. So bottom paint is changing, we're not very realistic sometimes, us sailors. We want a boat that can handle heavy weather but can also sail in very light winds. Well, that's going to be interesting. We want a bottom paint that's going to work well to get rid of barnacles and keep things from growing but is environmentally friendly. Well, bottom paint is about as far from environmentally friendly as any paint you can possibly imagine. It is horribly nasty stuff. So I wouldn't get crazy with the bottom paint thing. Just haul your boat out. If you see a lot of splotchy patchwork where you see big chunks of paint missing that have been painted over, you'll notice it doesn't look smooth. If it's really bad, if it looks like there's 15 years of paint piled on top of paint with big old patches missing of paint and all this, then you're going to have to strip it all the way down. You can do it using chemicals. There's a chemical stripping way to do it. Or you can do soda blasting, which is a whole ordeal and very expensive. But generally speaking, you just sand your boat and throw some paint on it and throw it back in the water. Painting the hull, you know, you're going to use all grip, more than likely, on a fiberglass boat. I have a steel boat, so I can paint it with whatever I want. I paint my boat, this sounds ridiculous, but I paint my hull with bilge paint, gray bilge paint. And I talked to the Pettit rep, and the Pettit rep said, basically, the bilge paint is identical to their like, sort of easy epoxy standard paint, and it's cheaper. And so, whatever, I'll paint my... But I will say right now, I got a work boat, you know, and you probably got a yacht. And I would like to make my work boat look as yachty as I can, in a sense. I don't want rust streaking down the sides. I want it to paint to look nice, and I want the boat to look nice. But a steel boat, and a boat that's really used and abused, you know, it's used for work, you know, that's going to be a different world. But if you had a real nice boat, you need to get all grip, and that's an expensive ordeal to get a boat repainted. As far as the propeller goes, when the boat is hauled out, there's a few options you have. You can get a spray paint, a can with spray paint of this gray anti-foul is sprayed on the propeller. I don't know how long it really lasts. I mean, every time I've hauled a boat out that I've sprayed that on before, there's not a single speck of it left anywhere to see. I'm guessing that when the prop spins through the water, it just kicks off all that paint, probably fairly quickly. The other option is a Lanacoat-based option. You buy it in these little plastic, they look almost like old tins. You screw the top off, and it's this Lanacoat, and you put it on your prop, and it's sort of a clear, sort of a little sticky, and you use like a paint scraper or something, and you stick it on your prop, and that works pretty well, and that's pretty cheap. The best thing to do is use something called Prop Speed. Prop Speed is really good stuff, but it's like $200 and some. And if you're going to get a line cutter, do not get the line cutters that look like a top of a tin can that's been cut off, because all those are going to do is, that's just going to cut your hands when you're trying to get the line off. I've swam on a boat that had a line wrapped around the prop, and it had one of those silly line cutters on it, and all I did is cut the crap out of my hand. If you want to get a line cutter, you got to get one where one part is stationary and one part is moving. And the best company for that is called Spurs. And look, they're not a sponsor, they never paid me a penny, but if you want to get a proper line cutter, Spurs makes the best one on the market by far that will really cut a line. Anyways, we've got to cut the commercial break.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, sitting in Port Annapolis Marina. My boat is on the hard. You know, every day it's grinding, sanding, scraping and painting, ripping out old stinky head hoses and heads, and at night, because I don't have proper power where I'm at, I can't run an air conditioner, so at night my boat is like literally 100 degrees. And then you toss and turn and sweat when you try to sleep, and then you get up with the sun rises and you start scraping and sanding and ripping out hoses all over again. And then you do it over and over for a few weeks. And that's what it's like. I live on a boat. You know, when my boat goes on the hard, I go on the hard with it. It's just what it is. But anyways, I want to talk to you guys a bit in this segment about plastic trash in the ocean. This is something that we spent quite a bit of time researching and working, an issue we've worked on quite a bit. in 2013 and also 2014. In 2013, we spent 70 days in the Atlantic doing this, which 70 days is the second longest I've ever been in the ocean. And we are focusing on the eastern side of the North Atlantic Gyre, or what also might be known as the Atlantic Garbage Patch. And there was sort of the far eastern side really hadn't, you know, much, you know, not much had been done. So it was sort of one of the last sort of unmapped regions of the Atlantic Gyre, the North Atlantic Gyre, when it comes to this plastic trash issue. And then in 2014, we sailed from San Francisco to Yokohama, Japan, nonstop on a 29-foot day sailor, and spent 64 days in the Pacific, also collecting samples, looking at the amount of plastic from one continent to another continent across an entire ocean. And 64 days was the third longest I've ever been in the ocean. There's all sorts of crazy stories to be told about these two expeditions, and I'll get into that in another time. And I'm going to be talking about this issue for the next couple of episodes. If there is anything good about this issue of plastic trash in the ocean, is that no matter, you can be on the far end of the liberal spectrum, you can be on the far end of the conservative spectrum, you can be anywhere in between, and every one of us can picture a plastic bottle floating in the ocean and understand that it's a problem. So if there is any good aspect of this really horrible issue, is that at least it hasn't been politicized. Like, at least it's not wrapped up in politics. It's so much easier to have a conversation about a scientific problem when politics haven't got involved. So there are five gyres in our Earth's oceans. A gyre is a large area of circulating current, sort of like a giant vortex. These gyres are in North Atlantic, South Atlantic, North Pacific, South Pacific, and Indian Ocean. So those are your five gyres. And the idea is a lot of these gyres are also associated with high pressure systems in the centers or near the centers. So high pressure systems are like doldrums. There's not a lot of wind. So you can imagine this giant area, you know, larger than the United States, of circulating current, of this vortex with very light winds in sort of the middle of it. And that's a very vague sort of way of explaining it, but that's the general aspects of it. Now, the entire gyre is not a garbage patch. The so-called garbage patches are going to be sort of in the epicenters of the gyres. So you have a pretty solid garbage patch between the United States and Europe in the Atlantic. And you have one also off of California and north of Hawaii. And it sort of fades off again, and then it builds. There's almost two garbage patches in the North Pacific, because you have one closer to Asia, and then you have one closer to the United States. And then you have a whole slew of garbage all over the place outside of that. So how did we get to this point? How did we get to the point where this is even an issue? Plastic is awesome. So I'm not beating up on plastic. Plastic is great. There's so many advancements, medical advancements, technological advancements, where plastic is absolutely crucial, and you don't want all forms of plastic to biodegrade. You don't want the plastic in your computer to biodegrade. You don't want the plastic in a pacemaker to biodegrade. So you know, there are some cases where you want plastic to be in that form where it lasts hundreds of years. Back after World War II, before World War II, we were more in the United States of an agricultural-based economy. After World War II, we were more of an oil-based economy. And before World War II, they used to talk about making plastic out of soybeans and out of plants. And Henry Ford, at one point, famously, before World War II, made a bumper, a plastic bumper out of soy and other plant material, and he beat it with a sledgehammer. He got all the media to come around, and he beat this thing with a sledgehammer. And he said, look at this. I predict in the future that we're going to have plastic all over these cars, and we're going to be making plastic from soybeans. Well, he was right about the plastic part. He wasn't that right about the plant-based plastics, because as we became more and more of an oil-based economy, we just used oil to make plastic. And that's what we have been doing. But that doesn't really get at the heart of the issue. After World War II, there was sort of a plastics campaign in the United States in particular, where they started sort of saying, hey, housewife, you know, you've got a lot to do. Yeah, all those pesky dishes, you don't have to wash those. Just use them once and throw them away. There's actually a great ad from the 1950s of this very happy family with little kids and husband and wife, and they're just throwing all sorts of plastic in the trash with giant smiles on their face. And this really started this boom of one-time use plastics. Just use it once and throw it away. How convenient, how easy. Who cares about the environment? They weren't thinking about environmental issues at that point. So time went on, we get into the 1950s, become the 1960s, become the 1970s, and more and more and more items are made of plastic and promoted in a one-time use scenario. 50% of the plastic trash in the oceans come from one-time use plastics. So by eliminating our use, by eliminating the one-time use, now I'm not saying completely eliminating, but let's say reducing. How's that for a better word? By reducing the amount of one-time use plastics, we can seriously reduce the amount of plastic trash in the ocean. So we don't dump our trash in the ocean anymore. We used to up until not that long ago. There are a lot of other countries that still dump their trash in the ocean. Some of that trash is plastic. And there's also other countries where, and this is pretty typical, the trash dump is right next to the ocean. I mean, like on the beach, basically. And so every time the wind blows, some trash will get blown off the pile and into the water. There's also runoff from storms that get into rivers, and there's a variety of different ways that the plastic trash makes it out into the ocean. There is no such thing as an island of garbage. All right? And this is very important because this is one of the biggest misconceptions of the whole issue. There is no island of plastic. You can't get off and walk around on it. It doesn't exist. I wish there was an island of garbage, of plastic garbage, because it'd be a lot easier to clean up. You know where it is. Go over there and clean it up. Bring a big freighter with you or something. But the problem is that the large pieces of plastic get broken down into smaller and smaller pieces. And majority of the plastic trash in the ocean is the size of your fingernail or smaller. So it's bits of plastic. Billions and billions of bits. Actually, 5.5 trillion pieces of plastic trash. That's the estimate. So hard to wrap your mind around, isn't it? Can you imagine 5.5 trillion of anything? Like anything. 5.5 trillion. I can't imagine 5.5 trillion $1 bills. I can't imagine 5.5 trillion beers, and I like beer. So it's really hard for us to even wrap our mind around how much plastic trash is actually out in the ocean. But as you can imagine, these little pieces of plastic, it's more like a soup than it is an island. It's integrated into the ocean itself into smaller and smaller and smaller bits that get eaten by the fish, get eaten by all sorts of different whales eat it, sea turtles, the birds out in the ocean eat it, a large variety of marine creatures. You got to remember that the open ocean is like a desert. And there's really not that much life in the open ocean, considering how much volume of water there is in the open ocean. So the creatures that live in the open ocean are scavengers, and they'll go after whatever. You know, anything they see that looks like food, they're going to try to eat it. It's impossible for us to understand how many fish are dying from this, because when a fish in the middle of the ocean dies, generally speaking, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And the bottom of the ocean in the open ocean is somewhere between 12,000 and 16,000 feet deep. I have heard that we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the bottom of the ocean. And so there's no good way for us to figure that out. How are we going to count that? But what we can do is the birds that live in the ocean, and believe it or not, there are birds that spend almost their entire life out in the ocean, and they only come to land to have babies. And Midway Island in the Pacific, where the Battle of Midway was fought in that region, which was the turning point for the U.S. in World War II. But anyways, you go to Midway Island, this guy went there, and he went there to film these birds. This was some years ago. And he didn't know about plastic trash. He wasn't going there because of that issue. He was going there to film some birds. And he starts looking around and noticing, man, there's like dead birds everywhere. And they got, you know, and they're like, you know, their bellies are full of plastic. And there's birds like feeding their babies plastic. And then their babies are dying. And it's like all over the place. And he starts filming it. And there's this thing called the gyre. It's like this short video. It's the saddest thing you ever seen. I mean, it makes you want to just jump off a cliff just watching it. But, you know, it's we can get a better understanding of how it's affecting marine creatures. And I'm using birds as marine creatures only because they spend their entire life in the ocean, except when they have babies. We got some idea by looking at these birds. There's no good way for us. Every once in a while, a whale washes up on shore with a belly full of plastic. And we can, you know, oh, look at this sperm whale. It's died from a belly full of plastic. The reality is most sperm whales or whatever that get a belly full of plastic are going to die, and they're not going to make it to that beach. So we're only seeing a very small percentage of how it's actually affecting marine creatures and species that live in the ocean. Another way it affects it, there are carcinogenics, specifically fire retardants, that are in these plastics. And especially some of the plastics made in Asia. Have some especially bad fire retardants. These fire retardants, when a fish eats the plastic, the fish absorbs these chemicals into its tissue. Then we eat the fish, and we end up eating our own chemicals. We eat our own trash, basically, through this process. So, you know, there's just, and you thought mercury was bad enough. I mean, it's a real problem. Now, if we take a step back and look at this in a little broader spectrum, 300 million tons of plastic are made every year. 8% of that plastic gets recycled. So 3 million tons are made, 8% is recycled. Now, let's just look at one type of plastic bags. Every year, 1 trillion plastic bags are used worldwide. In the United States, we use 102 billion plastic bags a year. About 11% of these plastic bags get recycled, and about 10% wind up in our ocean. So just about the same amount of plastic bags we recycle wind up in our waterways, our rivers, and eventually into the ocean. So that's pretty rough. Now, Sun Chips. Sun Chips made a bag about 7-8 years ago. It was the first 100% compostable bag for their potato chips. And this bag was, it wasn't 100% biodegradable. It wasn't like you can throw it out in the backyard and it's going to biodegrade. It's compostable, which means you need a high temperature composting facility. But it's something. It's a start, right? I mean, it's something. It's better than just a normal bag. That bag, when Sun Chips released that, their sales dropped by 11% in 18 months because people complained that the bag was too loud. Too loud. What do you mean the bag is too loud? Like, put the chips in a bowl or something if you got a problem with the noise. It seems like a ludicrous thing to complain about. But their sales dropped by 11%. So this means that the consumer, you know, it's going to take both the industry and the consumer to help make changes. And the consumer will stop buying a product that they normally purchase because of something as silly as a bag being too loud. It's such a minor inconvenience of a little too much noise or a little more noise than you're used to. You know, we want everything. We want it cheap and we want it now. We're obsessed with cheap and convenient. That's what we want, at least in the United States. We want it right now and we want it cheap. And something, you know, something as slightly inconvenient as a louder bag was enough to stop people from buying it. So that doesn't say much for the consumer. Now, the plastics industry is not putting much money, doesn't want to spend a lot of money developing true biopolymers because it costs millions of dollars. There are true biopolymers, PLA and PHA in particular, that like PHA has an 18-month half-life. If you throw it in the ocean, half of it will be gone in 18 months. But it's going to cost millions of dollars to develop these plastics. And the American Chemical Council is the lobby for the plastics industry. And it's very powerful, and it's very wealthy, and it's doing everything it can to keep everything just the way it is. And we don't have a lot of money, us small nonprofits. We don't have a lobby in Washington with millions and millions of dollars to try to fight these guys. So, you know, generally speaking, you know, there's about 5.5 trillion pieces of plastic in the ocean, somewhere around 270,000 tons, and it's only getting worse. So that's all the time I got to talk about it today, and that's just sort of the overall picture. We'll get into it in a little more details in the next episode.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet, you will find your moment.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ringnetter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Port Annapolis Marina, boats on the hard, been out in the sun, it's like 100 degrees out there or something, it's hot and sweaty and dirty and grindy and painty and all sorts of other fun stuff. But anyways, last time, we're now getting back into sailing stories, continue the story. And last episode, I talked a bit about when Whitney came and she sailed with me and had crazy seasickness in the beginning, and she did pretty well by the end. But anyways, we had gotten to Spain. So we're in Spain, we're in Basque country, we're eating tapas and drinking wine, and then Whitney leaves. And she goes back to wherever she went. I think she went back to work, back to the United States. But anyways, I continue on. Now, the north coast of Spain, we're talking the Atlantic coast of Spain, we're not talking the Mediterranean coast. The Atlantic coast is very different than the Mediterranean coast. It's greener, it's cooler temperatures, it's cheaper. I really, really like the Atlantic coast of Spain. So the sort of central Atlantic coast of Spain really isn't that great for sailing. They're really shallow inlets, narrow inlets. It's going to be a trickier place to get in and out of. But once you get to northwest Spain, you get to a region called Galicia. And Galicia is absolutely awesome. You start getting into all these rías. Ría is like a Spanish word for river. It's not really a river like you would think of a river. I guess it's sort of like they think of rivers in Ireland. It's sort of that sort of thing. But basically what this means is there's a lot of places you can go in, you can duck, you can anchor, there's little towns. So I came over to La Coruña, and I get in there, and I'm looking, I got this old cruising guide, and it shows where an anchorage is, and La Coruña is a pretty good size city in northwest Spain. And so I'm there, I'm looking at this old guide, and I'm pretty confused. It's like this anchorage that they're talking about, I don't see it anywhere. There's just a marina. And so eventually I tie it off to one of the docks at the marina, and I walk down and I find a guy, and in sort of broken English, you know, I say, you know, where's the anchorage? Like, I thought there was an anchorage right here. He's like, yeah, well, there used to be an anchorage right here, and we extended our docks so far out that we basically, there's nowhere else to anchor. So I decided, he said, well, why don't you go check out Sada? It's like in the next Ria over. So I left out and came in and pulled into another Ria. Rias are, like I said, there's these very protected. Once you get in one, it's sort of like a river in a sense. But I came into the Ria and came in, I don't know what it was, maybe 10 miles or 5 miles, something like that, and wound up in Sada. Sada is a smaller town. It has a little harbor with a seawall. And I came in there and I just grabbed the mooring ball. There's just a mooring ball sitting there. So I just commandeered it, basically. And I found out pretty quickly who owned the mooring ball. You know, you went around asking around, and the guy said, yeah, just you can stay on it as long as you want. I don't care. So great, I got a free mooring to stay on. And I decided to hang out in this place for a while, and I quickly meet people. There's an American guy on a big, like, 1920s wooden sailboat with this gigantic old-school diesel. Hung out with him for a couple days, and then he left, and he introduced me to this lady who, like, she cleans houses and, like, makes beds, and, I mean, she does pretty remedial, low-paid work, but she was a great woman, and her name was something like Margarita. I never could pronounce it 100% properly, but I started hanging out with her, like, every day, basically, and the nice thing about this particular region, Galicia, is you can get a baguette still warm, a fresh warm baguette for 50 cent. I could get a thing of brie for like 1 euro or pate, a couple of nice plum tomatoes, and a bottle of wine, all for 6 euro. So I was living off of 6 euro a day. And I was living off of baguettes, brie, and wine, but hey, that sounds pretty good to me. And the wine for like 1 or 2 euro a bottle was surprisingly good wine. So Galicia, it's been remarked when I was there that Galicia is sort of like the hillbillies of Spain. I think that's probably a really horrible way to describe Gallegos, the people in Galicia. But it is a bit of a... I don't know, it's a different mentality there, and it's a mentality I really like. It is more laid back, a little more rural, I guess. And so anyways, I'm on this free mooring ball, and I'm hanging out in Galicia, and I start really, really liking the place. And there's this really weird thing happened with this dolphin. I'm sitting there one day, and I'm on the back of my boat. Maybe I've been in Galicia, maybe I've been on this mooring ball for, you know, 4 days or something at this point, and I'm like messing with my grill. I'm about to throw some food on the grill. I see this dolphin jump like 1 foot from my grill, and higher than I was, and I was standing on my boat, and this dolphin is huge. It's like 12 or 14 feet. This is not like a little dolphin that you see when you're in the ocean. This is like SeaWorld, you know, flipper freaking giant bottlenose dolphin. I almost fell off my boat. I mean, I fell backwards because also I'm just sitting there and this giant, massive dolphin thing is like 1 foot from me. And I'm like, whoa, you know. And then I see like, you know, other little boats coming and going, and the dolphin plays with the other boats, and sometimes it jumps right next to my boat. And oh, that's really cool. You know, this is great, man. I got this show. I can watch this dolphin play with other boats. You know, just sitting on my boat. It's like watching the dolphin show, you know. Well, it started off a really good thing. It actually became a bit of a nightmare. I rowed my dinghy. I didn't have an outboard. I had oars. And I wasn't very far from the dock that I had to row to. You know, I was a little ways, but it wasn't more than, I don't know, maybe a 5-minute row. Well, this dolphin would wait for me. And when I got into my dinghy and I started rowing, it would grab the oars. When the oar was in the water, it would grab the oar and it would steal it from me. It would rip it right out of my hand and steal it in the water. And next thing I know, like a few minutes, like maybe 30 seconds later, the oar would pop back up again somewhere else. Like the dolphin grabbed the oar, ripped it out of my arm, like a complete surprise the hell out of you. You're just rowing along, and all of a sudden the oar just gets ripped out of your arm and just disappears underwater. And then it pops up somewhere else, and you take your one oar, and you go try to chase it. And while you're rowing with your one oar, trying to get your other oar, the dolphin's trying to steal that oar. And it became this whole ordeal where, like, every time I would go back and forth, I would have to, like, scan the horizon trying to see any signs of this dolphin, because if the dolphin was around, it would steal my oars when I was trying to row. And it became a real problem because it did it all the time. Like, it wasn't like once or twice. It was like this dolphin was like lurking, waiting for me at any moment so it could like steal my oars and run away with them. So, you know, that was pretty interesting to say the least. But I like SADA so much that I actually tried to get a job there and teach English. And I found some schools that would hire me, but sort of the way that the visa situation goes is you cannot apply for a visa when you're in the country. I would have to go back to the United States and then apply for the visa. And you have to find a job who is willing, you know, like a place that is willing to hire you before you even apply. And you have to have a skill that they can't find locally. That's the argument. So it was English, teaching English. I found some places that would hire me. Not because I'm great with English. I mean, hell, you guys can hear me talk. I mean, I'm not, I know I barely speak the King's proper English, but I can barely spell. But they just wanted somebody who spoke English with a U.S. accent, with an American accent. And so I'm thinking, well, hell, you know, I really want to stay in Spain. I love it here. The wine is good. The women are beautiful. Spanish women are some of the most beautiful women in the whole world. And the music I liked everything about it. They have in Galicia, and this is probably in a lot of Spain, in the summer months, there's like fiestas all over the place, these big parties. They shoot off fireworks in the daytime. I never really understood that. I mean, you see it all the time. Well, I should say you hear it all the time because you can't see anything. Like, what's the point of shooting a firework in the daytime? You're supposed to wait till nighttime, right? So you can see it. But it's all for the noise, you know? So they launch fireworks. You're always hearing these little fireworks shooting off. And they got this stuff called quemada. It's like this moonshine sort of stuff that they light on fire. And they put, like, some sugar and some lime in it when it's on fire. And it's supposed to be like this old witches thing. Sometimes it's just like a witches chant thing. And then you drink it. Of course, you put the fire out before you drink it. But it's like moonshine you light on fire and throw some sugar and lemon in there and then drink it. It's freaking awesome. Anything that you can light on fire and drink is great, as far as I'm concerned. So it's just all this cool stuff, man. Beautiful women, great music, great food, great wine. Freaking, you know, I could live here for a while, you know? So I got this crazy idea that I'm going to sail alone across the Atlantic from Spain back to the United States, which is not like a normal route at all. I know of one guy who did this back in like the 1980s. It can be done, but the problem is you're going to sail right through the middle of the doldrum that I was speaking of in the last segment where the garbage patch is. This is the proper name for this doldrum is the Bermuda Azores High Pressure System. Yeah, so you got to go right through the middle of the Bermuda Azores High. And, you know, it's going to be, it would be difficult. It'd be very difficult to sail directly from Spain back to the United States. It's just, you're not, that is not the way you usually do it. But anyways, it's not impossible. Difficult is not impossible. And obviously, I mean, I hadn't sailed around the Americas yet, but obviously I wasn't afraid of a challenge. So I go to the grocery store, I buy, you know, 6 weeks worth of groceries, I get all this water, I get a bunch of wine, I throw it in my boat, I push out of, I've been in SADA for about a month now. I mean, I really like the place. I was trying to stay there. I've been on that mooring ball for about a month. And I've been hanging out with that lady, this margarita lady, who I never could pronounce her name. I tried to pronounce her name. I don't know. I'm horrible at that sort of thing. She's a wonderful woman. And she was an older lady. You know, we just hung out. We're just friends. Drink wine. And she played a flamenco guitar, you know, Spanish guitar. Anyways, I leave to do a transatlantic. South of this area of La Coruña is an area, is Finisterre, will be the next thing you come across. Finisterre was sort of the end of the world to the Roman Empire. So this is as far as the Roman Empire knew. After Finisterre, it was like, you know, the map ended, basically. And there's this whole stretch called the Coast of Dead Souls. It's supposed to be really stormy. Finisterre is notorious for being stormy. I remember sitting off Finisterre about 5 or 6 miles. I could see Finisterre, the land out in the distance, and I was completely becalmed. And I hadn't been out at sea very long at this point. I don't know how long it... I mean, I left that morning, and this is the afternoon or evening. It's not that far. I don't remember being at sea for that long beforehand, at the very least. So I'm sitting there thinking, uh-huh, yeah, the Coast of Dead Souls, uh-huh, Finisterre, yeah, real windy, guys, because I'm becalmed. I'm just bobbing. I spend hours bobbing off Finisterre, like 5 miles off it, just sitting there bobbing like a cork with no wind, thinking, yeah, okay, real windy, guys. And then, like hubris does, it caught up to me that evening. And it started blowing harder and blowing harder. And then it was blowing a gale. And I'm beating into this wind and I'm pounding. And yeah, it was actually blew. I had a board up on my my bow pulpit. I had two boards on my bow pulpit. And I came down so hard off a wave that it disintegrated one of those boards. It just blew it to pieces. And that was the only time that ever happened. I was in stronger winds in other places. But I was pretty impressed by that, by the waves being able to destroy this board. And I noticed in the morning when the sun came up that I was having a leak at my pump, my water pump on my engine was leaking. So I decided, all right, well, I'm going to go back over to Spain. And you know, I wasn't very far from Spain. I mean, I could still basically see it. And I'm going to get this engine fixed and reassess. And I go into this nice town and I get a cold beer and I meet a couple people. We have a nice conversation. I go back to my boat. I watch the most beautiful sunset. And I think, well, instead of going back to the United States, why don't I just keep sailing south? And so it was really funny. I left to do a transatlantic and I wound up like, I don't know, less than 100 miles down the coast in this town and totally changed my mind and decided let's just keep sailing south. It's really strange for me to do that. Normally, when I set my mind on doing something, I do it. But in this case, you know, I was only... I guess I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I left... I didn't know. I was lonely, too, at this point. You know, I was lonely, and I didn't really know what to do. And I thought that I was going to cross the Atlantic, and I changed my mind. Anyways, I'll get back into this story next episode. You can always check out the videos and everything at oceanresearchproject.org. You can make a donation via PayPal on the website. I'm also a yacht broker, work for David Walters, the Rogue Wave Division. So if you want to buy a boat, you know, I've been helping people, help connect people with boats that make sense for what they're doing. And we're trying to find people turnkey boats where, you know, you don't want to be the person who puts $50,000 into a boat. You want to buy a boat from the guy who put $50,000 into it. So we try to help, find boats that are going to be, well, as stress-free as possible. And boats are never cheap, and they're never completely stress-free. But there are definitely better boats out there than others. And, I've been doing this for a long time, so I can help. And I've made a lot of mistakes myself in the past. So I try to help people, prevent people from making the mistakes that I made in the past. So anyways, thanks for listening, and talk to you guys next week.
Yeah.
see through.
Şunu kıyma bugün.